This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Before I get started, just a couple of quick comments. I think you all know that Merced is growing. UC Merced is growing very rapidly. In fact, it's only been within the last year or so where the number of our alums actually exceeds the number of students on campus at any given time. So that's how rapidly we've been growing. So needless to say, we don't have an alumni base like Berkeley has, and you know how important an alumni base is to the growth and vitality of a campus. But what we do have is a core group of people who are incredibly dedicated to the success of that campus. Some of them are in the community, that have fought for the positioning of the campus there. Some of them are part of the local businesses. Some of them are former employees. And one person who has given so much to our campus in so many ways is Karen Merritt. And it's a great honor for us to have, first of all, a program that not a single graduate can walk through without going through that program, cannot graduate, and that's the Merritt Writing Program. And another program, hold your applause, please, for just 1 second, is we recognize those people that have given the ultimate gift in terms of estates and wills and remembering UC Merced, and that's the Merritt Legacy Society. And we like the names of both of those because it serves two purposes. First of all, those programs really do contribute to the merit of our institution, and they're named after someone who is very special. So, Karen, thank you for everything you've done. So Dan and I would like to talk to you today about UC Merced. We'd like to talk a little bit about the past, a little bit more about the present, but mostly about the future. And I'm just kind of curious, how many of you in this room have been to the UC Merced campus? Wow, great. This is good. Okay, fantastic. And those of you that haven't been there, have you at least driven through Merced on the way to Yosemite so you know more or less where we're at? Okay, good. So that's where we're going to start. I think I don't have to tell this crowd that 7 of the 10 UC campuses can see the ocean from where they're at. There are 3 that can't. And we're one of them. So Merced, Riverside, and Davis, of course, are in the inland. And we were positioned there to really serve a very important part of the state in the San Joaquin Valley. And it's kind of a little bit hard to see, but that's sort of the first phase of construction in UC Merced with the mountains in the background. And I think you all know that it was built on the county golf course. These are the primary missions for the campus. Obviously, to accommodate the ever-increasing demand for opportunities to study at a research university in the UC system, to focus our attention on providing that opportunity to people in the Central Valley, and to use that, not only the undergraduate, but also the graduate education opportunities, and the fact that we are a research university, to contribute to the development of new knowledge and hopefully, by so doing, contribute to the growth of the economy of the region. I'm not a real fan of rankings. I think you become more of a fan when you show up higher in the rankings. But one recognition that this campus received from, I think it's called the Washington Group, within the last 6 or 8 months, is we were ranked in the top 5 in the entire country for our contributions to social mobility. And what that really means is, what is the value added to the students that come to our institution and from the background that they come and the position that they come and what opportunities they have when they leave the institution? And we're very proud of that. And we also think, as I said earlier, that it's one thing to contribute to the economic foundation of the institution or the economic foundation of the region by just the payroll of the institution. But it's quite another thing to contribute by the new knowledge and educational and economic opportunities that are generated. And that takes time. It's not something that happens quickly. But it's not going to happen if we don't build very strong research programs. And, of course, that's a fundamental characteristic of the entire UC system. And so we need to make sure that we deserve to be part of that entire system. So this is just a little bit about the students that come to UC Merced. Our undergraduate students are virtually all Californians, and that's, I think it's important to remember that. 99% of our students are undergraduates from California. About a third come from the Central Valley, about another third from the greater LA region, and about another third from the Bay Area. 71% of our undergraduates come from a home where no one has been to a university. So they don't have a relative that can talk to them about what a university experience is about. Most of them, almost two-thirds, are low-income, Pell-eligible students. And over half of them choose majors in STEM fields. And I think this says a lot about what, you know, what they see as the opportunity and the responsibility they have in coming to a university. They really hope that it will contribute to their opportunity to contribute in a greater way economically. And we have about 520 graduate students, which is about 7%. That's about half the percentage of the average through the UC system. So clearly that's a number that we're trying to increase. And an incredibly diverse, the most diverse population of students in the UC. Half are Hispanic, about another quarter Asian Pacific Islander. You can see this pie chart. So about 11% are white students. This is how we've grown. As I said, we have been on a steady growth trajectory with one exception, and that is 2013, 2014. We took a little bit of a pause because we had just saturated all the buildings that we had, and we needed a little bit of a break before the next set of buildings came online. But we are on a trajectory right now. We're a little over 7,000 students to reach 10,000 students, hopefully in 2020 or 2021. So let me say a little bit something about the incredible faculty that we have on this campus. First of all, just some basic information about demographics. What you have on the left here is a chart of the age distribution. Pick out UC Merced. This is the age distribution of all 10 campuses. We have an incredibly young faculty, right? They are early in their careers, and this on the right is the percent of untenured ladder rank faculty, a very high fraction of faculty that are just beginning their careers. And Karen could probably talk a little bit more about this, but for various reasons, not least of which is you needed to get the doors open and start offering curricula on our campus, there were a number of lecturers that were hired to be able to offer the curricula. And as a consequence, we are working towards increasing the ratio of our ladder rank faculty to lecture or to decrease the opposite ratio. And that's not to say that lecturers aren't incredibly important. They are. But clearly, as a UC campus, we need to move that ratio of ladder rank faculty to lecturers up. And this just kind of reiterates the point I made earlier, that is, on most campuses, well over half of the ladder rank faculty are full professors. Here, about half are untenured assistant professors. So the distribution is almost inverted on our campus. That won't be that way forever, obviously, but it will certainly be that way for the foreseeable future as we continue to hire. So I want to talk just a very little bit about what processes are we using to hire faculty. And you can think about, the reality is on any campus, you never have as much resources as you think you need. And certainly when you are hiring faculty, there has to be some means for prioritizing. One could prioritize by saying, well, we're going to preferentially grow political science over chemistry. But I think given the nature of our campus and the fact that all of our programs need to grow, the question is, how could we grow in a way that benefits all the disciplines, but in a way that emphasizes the strengths that we have? So to make a very long story short, we engaged the campus in trying to identify some key areas, broad areas that we felt we had strength and areas that we wanted to build in those strengths, and tried to focus a reasonable fraction of the faculty hires in those key areas. Keeping in mind now, this is not to say that we are abandoning traditional disciplines. Anyone that's hired in these areas would have a tenure home in a traditional discipline. But With the help of the faculty, we did identify six key areas. And you can see they're broad areas. They're not singularly unique. These are areas, I'm sure, that are emphasized in various ways on this campus and many others. But this is the so-called strategic hiring initiative that we have begun to use to hire preferentially in these areas. And I just wanted to very quickly talk about them. So one focuses on issues related to a sustainable planet. Well, you know, you can see quite clearly that we've gone from drought to flood, you know, in 1 year. But we could just as easily go back to drought conditions in another year. And so this whole question of how we understand the impact of the snow pack in the Sierras, how we can sensor and monitor those conditions wirelessly and remotely, how we can model those conditions are all part of our research portfolio, and one of the key contributors to that is our Sierra Nevada Research Institute. And again, Karen was instrumental in getting that established. We have a lot of work in that same area in sustainability that focuses on precision agriculture. I like to say that UC Merced is the stealth agriculture college in the UC system. We don't have a school of agriculture, but we have a lot of research that's taking place in all three of our schools related to agriculture, from precision agriculture that depends significantly on drones to remote sensing and monitoring using drones and so forth. Human health science is another area. Very early on, there was a lot of talk about when UC Merced is going to have a medical school, and I think everybody knows that that's a very expensive proposition. But even though we can't have a medical school in the near future, there are a lot of ways we can contribute to health science education, public health, various areas of research that focus on the health disparities that you see in underserved regions, and certainly the region in which we live is significantly underserved in that regard. So we have people looking at valley fever, folks looking at behavioral modification like smoking cessation that has a significant impact on health, and people in our biological and bioengineering program looking at tissue engineering. So these are just some examples of some of the work that we're doing. A lot of emphasis on computational science and data analytics, using it especially for spatial analysis. We have an incredibly strong cognitive and information sciences program that has quite a bit of interest in this area, but of course you would see this also emphasized in the engineering and sciences and robotics and so forth. Adaptive functional materials, which very simply is what can you do on the micro and the nanoscale, at the molecular scale, to affect macro properties? What can you do in changing the molecular structure that might improve the efficiency, for example, of photocells, photovoltaics? UC Solar, the major research program that is throughout the entire UC system, is actually headquartered at Merced. We have faculty in chemistry and physics doing a lot of work on quantum dots, and they're impact and application to memory devices and quantum computing. So these are just some examples. One of the programs that I think is particularly noteworthy and a signature element on our campus is the involvement that we have in our engineering school in integrated team-based design projects that are actually sponsored and defined by industry. So there's a lot of interaction with local business, and as you can imagine, we don't have the wealth and breadth of business opportunities to interact with that you would have in a Bay Area. But nonetheless, we've been able to define a whole series of partnerships that allow our students to have that experience. And a significant amount of work, particularly in our School of Social Sciences, Humanities, and Arts, looking at issues related to social justice and the challenges of underserved communities. And this was not a plant, I promise you, but one of the authors of one of the books that is up here is Laura Hamilton, one of our faculty members, is here. It scares me to death. I'm not going to talk about her work because I'll mess it up. But it's a real honor to have quite a few faculty who are doing internationally recognized research that has a very local application. I think that's an important thing to realize. We're not a regional university. We are a research university that aspires to have an international reputation. But we have so many faculty that can do that quality of research, and find a very direct application to the community. work in anthropology and archaeology, whether it's in the local sense, and this is an example of, I think it's a mastodon skeleton that was unearthed just right next to Interstate or Highway 99 as they were building an interchange, to work that's done in Central America, looking at the indigenous tribes there and what they can learn from the things that they found in caves, to work that's being done in Nepal and Tibet with respect to the impact of those cultures on the Silk Road. In fact, those of you that watch PBS, you may have seen within the last about 3 months a really nice program on NOVA called The Secret of the Sky Tombs, and it was all about Mark Aldendurfer and the work that he's doing. If you're a sustaining member of KQED, you can actually get that on. That's a plug for KQED. So before I turn this over to Dan, let me just say what I've tried to do is talk a little bit about how the faculty are growing to meet this incredible growth rate in students, and hopefully illustrated that we're trying to do that in a very strategic way. So the question is, how do we provide the physical structure and the capital plant to meet the needs of the students and faculty? And with all due respect to Judd King, who I'm just really honored to have him in the audience here, I would say that chancellors and provosts are a dime a dozen. Okay, we come and go. With Dr. King's exception, all right? I'm just talking about myself right now. But I think we all know that the growth of our campus is taking place at a time that is quite unlike the growth that took place when any of the other UC campuses sprung up, particularly in the 60s. We don't have a basis of state support that we can rely on for building. So if we're going to grow, we have to figure out singularly unique ways to do that. How we finance it, how we plan not only to grab a shiny new building when it's finished and move into it, but how do we make sure that that building 40 years from now isn't falling apart around us, where, as so many campuses, including this one, is struggling with huge financial responsibilities associated with deferred maintenance. So it took a very special person to figure that out. And behind his back, we call Dan the Boy Wonder, because he brought a non-academic perspective, a business and a banking perspective, to an academic environment. And this is truly a project that is singularly unique in the academic world. It's been done in other ways, and I'm sure he'll talk to you about it. But the fact that we are kind of the poster child for this particular way could either... We'll either go down in flames or we're going to be an example that many other campuses will look like. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be the latter. So with that rather inglorious introduction, Dan, it's all yours.
Well, thank you, Tom. That was quite a bit of pressure in terms of how this project will move forward. But thank you, Michael and Karen and Diana, for bringing us here today and for hosting this conversation. It's truly an honor to be with so many distinguished scholars to talk about the challenges and opportunities that we have within public higher education. And I've been lucky in these several years to work with Tom as he and our faculty lead the development of our young campus. And Tom and I started on the same day, almost 5 years ago, and he gave you a little bit of background where I was coming in brand new to an academic environment, and you've truly helped shape what it means to serve in the administration of a research institution for me. That's because I came to the this opportunity from the private sector, and I spent about 13 years in public finance and infrastructure. But as a recovering investment banker, I thought that my role coming in was sort of the highest and best form of public service. But, you know, Tom helped me understand deeply the role of administration in a research university. And in that realm, our, you know, the administration's job is really to be but one cog in a wheel and to help facilitate the ability of our faculty and students to find success. And so that we need to be focusing as much as we can every day on enabling our students to learn how to learn and for our faculty to research and be solving problems of unique nature. And that helped within my expertise to come into an environment and think about how we build. And you know, at that time, of course, we were facing significant and complex challenges of our own as an entire University of California community. The university had 5,000 students at that time. We had three buildings almost under construction. But when we started this process back in 2012, the state of California had just cut our budget collectively by $650 million. We were facing the threat of another $250 million cut if Proposition 30 was not adopted. And investment largely in the state of California in our universities and schools had virtually come to a halt in the wake of the financial crisis. And our Chancellor Dorothy Leland had just arrived on campus 6 months ago with the charge of helping build our campus, which of course Tom and I came to join her to help do. And in October of this year, as you know, the campus broke ground on the 2020 project, which is a unique public-private partnership. It's a $1.3 billion building project. It really is a major investment by the UC Board of Regents in the development of UC Merced, and it will enhance access to public higher education for California's youth and right in the heart of underinvested California. And we think it's opening up a new chapter in terms of procurement for how public universities and educational entities can contract for what is a performance-based contract, and we call it an availability payment contract. And the circumstances, of course, that led us down the path at this point in time to consider this particular contracting structure was fairly unique. But I think we're learning lessons that can be applied more broadly. And those are what I'd like to share with you today. And the short reason why we did this was so that we would build what we could afford to maintain, so that the facilities we build are constructed and designed and constructed with a preventative capital maintenance function built into the contract. And those are based on performance standards. And because the facilities would perform to the standards over the life cycle of the facilities, we then know that our civil and social infrastructure will not only be sustainable, but it will help provide the economic opportunity for our region, and it will help focus our institution on teaching, research, and public service. And as we began to think about it, we realized the life cycle of our facilities are very short. Like governments, universities and colleges are some of the most durable institutions in the world, and they must be. Berkeley is 150 years old and will be here for many centuries to come. And as we're looking to build UC Merced, we recognize today the campus is just 11, but we need to build the foundation for an institution that's going to stand the test of time. So when we arrived, the short-term needs were quite apparent. UC, of course, had placed the campus in Merced with the idea that it would raise levels of educational attainment in the valley, and that over time it would be a model of sustainability with a pledge to achieve triple net zero standards with energy efficient, LEED certified buildings and cutting edge technology. And of course, to do that, over the first several years, the state of California helped finance those first facilities, much in the same way it financed other facilities in our sister campuses through state lease revenue bonds. But that also required us to select the technology with which we were going to build sustainable and durable buildings. And so that made us think about how to make sure we were putting the right incentives in our facilities and how we were going to be sustainable. But we were also recognizing that in 2012, our budget woes were very deep, And we had to think about new ways to innovate the growth of our campus because the road ahead was quite unclear. And to meet growing admission for our students at that point in time, we were putting students in dormitories. We were doubling singles and tripling doubles on every room on campus. We were looking to lease space off campus for students. Our students were having to meet in off-campus trailers for clubs and activities, and classes were being held in well into the night and often on weekends as well. And so in order to address the growing demand that the University of California was asking us to absorb, we needed to look to double enrollment during this time and build the facilities to do so when the first phase of our campus had virtually been built out. And so if that wasn't daunting enough, when we began to look at the long-range development plan that the Board of Regents put in place in 2009, we didn't believe that that would be financially feasible. Essentially, it called for us to triple the amount of facilities and the space on which we would build in order to double the enrollment of campus. So we knew we needed to make a change. And the first decision that Chancellor Leland made was to reduce the footprint on which we would expand the campus by half. We originally were going to expand from 105 acres to 355, and she brought that down to a total of 219 acres. But as we began to look at the master plan, we knew we faced time pressure because in order to meet growing enrollment, we had to have facilities developed by 2018 and all of our facilities by 2020 to meet the enrollment targets that were being put in front of us. And we faced questions about financing because the state of California was in the midst of passing legislation that would transfer its historic responsibility for financing academic facilities to the Board of Regents. And we also faced questions about how we would do this and maintain the standards of sustainability and carbon neutrality that we wanted to invest in our physical footprint. But even if we were to find a way to do that, to finance the buildings, we also felt that there was a longer-term problem we had to face, and that was the issue of durability of our facilities. And for the last several decades, you know, most public sector agencies, be them universities or government agencies at the federal, state, or local level, have primarily focused on infrastructure development and financing. How do we get the project built? And today, in the United States, we have some of the world's most foremost design and construction markets, and we have the world's most efficient financing markets. But in general, we find that governments have not conducted preventative capital maintenance. And when we don't practice preventative maintenance, it often gets more expensive to rebuild the asset at the end of its useful life. And when we find that the assets are at their useful life, there may not be funding available in order to repair them immediately. And we all know this project, this problem is becoming more and more acute in our society. And deferred maintenance is a huge problem we have to deal with. And since our institutions must endure beyond the useful life of our facilities, we have to begin to recognize that the life cycle of the buildings we built in the context of our durable institutions is relatively short. And we have to look at ways to build that avoid that those deferred maintenance problems down the road. And so we have to build what we can afford to maintain. And we have to make decisions up front in our development process that consider life cycle costs. We have to consider not just the design and construction costs in our capital budgets, but also the cost of the financing, the operations, and the maintenance of those facilities over time. And that's where the consideration of a new delivery model came in. And our hope was to identify a structure that would enable us to rapidly build the campus, but also to maintain it over time. And so we began to look at all of the options. We looked at building the campus in one, two, or three phases. We looked at traditional development structures like design, bid, build, design, build. We looked at lease-leasebacks, which are common in the student housing marketplace. And we looked at the availability payment concession model, which was a new emerging model that had been used for public facilities in hospitals around the world, and in other physical buildings, and very commonly in transportation, in airports and parking, but was new to the United States and hadn't been yet been used in higher education. We also looked at different phasing structures, and we worked very intensively with the regents, and ultimately settled on bundling the project into a single phase, single contract with one entity, with timelines for when the buildings would come online. And that was because of our time-sensitive needs across all of the different types of buildings we were building. The larger, more comprehensive project allowed us to look at getting economies of scale, to build a mixed-use academic environment, which is one where we can be more flexible about whether classrooms are near student housing or the placement of research laboratories relative to dining. And so it allowed us to also attract world-class talent into California's Central Valley to take on this challenge. But we selected an availability payment concession model because it enabled an interdisciplinary approach to these questions about design and construction and long-term operations and maintenance. The structure itself helps us achieve good building performance over the life cycle of the facilities, and it enables us to share payment and performance risk. We would have confidence that our procurement process would foster the competition across the total cost of ownership so that we would drive down all of our costs. And this is a model that's different from other public-private partnership structures that universities have used in the past. There's no transfer of property rights, so there's no lease. If the development consortium fails to deliver, they do not have rights to lease our buildings to other parties. There is no transferring of revenue risk. In some student housing public-private partnerships, the developer will earn the revenue from student housing as compensation for their development. In our case, we manage all of our programs. We collect student housing revenue and parking and manage all of our programs and make fixed predetermined payments similar to a fixed rate bond. But it adds performance standards into the contract. And these performance standards tell the developer that our building must have certain attributes all through the life cycle of the buildings. The elevators must be working. The electricity must be on. The roofs cannot leak. We must achieve the same building efficiency standards that the regents have put in policy. Our buildings must be 20% better than Title 24. We must have LEED Gold buildings. And if they don't meet those standards, there is a determination made by the university that the buildings become unavailable and they're not performing to those standards. And the payments that we've promised then have a deduction. And so while we always face in our facilities the risk that things might go wrong, when we take full ownership of those facilities, the university then must come in and fix them and pay for the remediation of that problem when things go wrong. In this instance, it is incumbent upon the developer because the developer will not only be losing the payments promised from the original construction of the building, but if they don't cure it, they continue to have those deductions. And so they have that built-in incentive to make sure that the buildings are operating at the performance standards we set forth. And so that is the structure at a very high level of our 2020 project. The project itself is a combination of social and civil infrastructure that will deliver 1.2 million gross square feet of space over the next year. It includes teaching and research facilities. It includes housing, athletics, and student life spaces. And it's a small, smart city, a research university where accomplished scholars are focusing on working with our students and working to solve real-world problems, and in a place that we believe will be well-maintained over the next 40 years so that the risks we take and the energies we focus are not on our facilities issues, but rather on the academic mission of the institution. So I'll show you the project, and then I can come back and talk about some of the lessons we've learned along the way.
Mm-hmm.
UC Merced, the newest member of the venerable University of California, is taking the next big step in its development. By 2020, the campus will nearly double its physical capacity, allowing enrollment of up to 10,000 students. The campus's new primary corridor, the Academic Walk, is centrally located and exclusively dedicated to pedestrian activity. The area includes student housing, space for student life activities, a wellness center, athletic and recreational facilities, and a one-stop student services center. The new buildings bordering Little Lake will be highly efficient, flexibly designed, and thoughtfully positioned to enable routine interaction among faculty, students, and staff, creating a dynamic, sustainable 24/7 environment to learn, live, work, and play. The new academic quad, anchored by wet and dry laboratories, including a computational lab, will become a hub of UC Merced's research activities and a bridge connecting the existing campus facilities. Our new central dining center will continue UC Merced's architectural tradition, a modern take on the Central Valley's agricultural roots. Using simple materials and a long-span steel structural system, planners have created an expansive, state-of-the-art facility. A window wall provides views of Little Lake, engaging the surrounding natural environment and acting as an iconic and inviting addition to the campus. UC Merced remains committed to its ambitious sustainability goals. Through an innovative combination of strategic building design, construction, and operations, we will continue to be a leader in sustainability in higher education. That innovation extends to our research and academics, as students and faculty members learn and work in an intimate, interdisciplinary academic environment. The campus expansion is designed to encourage new approaches to collaborative learning and research as the university grows in strategically defined research areas. The 2020 project will allow UC Merced to serve even more of California's students, transforming lives, enriching our community, and developing stronger connections with the Central Valley. Join us as we continue to fulfill our mission of teaching, research, and public service in the rich tradition of the University of California, while moving our region, the state, and the world toward a brighter future.
So as we begin the project, I'll talk first a little bit about the financing, and then come back to some of the procurement lessons we learned. And in a typical structure, the Board of Regents, this project is costing $1.3 billion. And in a typical design bid build or design build methodology, which is what we've used in the past, we would have to make $1.3 billion of payments to the contractor by the time they finish construction. And so that would have required the Board of Regents to issue $1.3 billion of bonds. In our financial structure, we have reduced the amount of bonds that the university must issue by the time the completion of the project occurs. So we will be paying by 2020 approximately $600 million for these facilities. But we will have to pay back the balance of the cost over time, so long as the buildings are performing to the performance standards that are set forth in the contract. And so the developer, Plenary Properties Merced, has been required to invest $700 million in the construction of the facility, and they will be repaid over time so long as the buildings are meeting their performance standards. In the process that we used, that allowed us to think about all of the life cycle costs, because built into the amount that we repay Plenary Properties is their cost of maintenance. They've incorporated that into their bid because they knew they would be required to perform those services. And so some of the decisions that we made along the way to be more efficient with our land or be thoughtful about the types of facilities we were building and how much are designed with estimates about these life cycle costs. And so we've tried to build those into a long-range financial pro forma that allows us to have a financially sustainable future. That, of course, is is subject to all of the risks that we typically face as a university. Demand risk, but risk that the state of California will continue to invest in public higher education. Risk inflation will be driving costs beyond our control. So we still face financial risks, but they're managed in the context of our mission, not the possibility that 20 years down the line, unforeseen events occur in facilities, and we then have to make major investments at a time where we weren't foreseeing those to occur. Some of the other lessons we learned and we're thinking about is, of course, the economic development mission of the campus. And 50 years ago, the state of California, through federal and state investment, built our transportation system along up and down the state, from airports to highways. It made major investments in our water conveyance systems and, of course, in the expansion of the University of California. And as a result, our coastal cities remain some of the fastest growing regions of our nation, from Sacramento to San Francisco, LA, and San Diego. But the San Joaquin Valley in rural California was really left behind. And so infrastructure investment, UC Merced, other types of infrastructure investment, we know holds the promise to bring the San Joaquin Valley back into the California economy, because it creates and supports jobs, it fosters stability, it brings innovation, research, and new graduates to the heart of underinvested California. We also learned many lessons about our interactions with key stakeholders. And in order to move the process forward, we had to navigate complex political and governance processes both inside and outside of the university. Inside the university, we had to think a lot about refining the trajectory of the growth of the campus in its original master plan to accept a much more compact campus, and also accept the notion that unless we have major investments in public higher education going forward, that there may not be money to immediately continue to expand after we reach 10,000 students in 2020. Within the University of California, of course, it meant seeking a commitment from the Board of Regents to invest in the project. And that investment, of course, we recognize comes at a cost to the other nine campuses. This is a system-wide project that we're all investing in. And the campus is very, very grateful for the support of all of our sister campuses and for the Board of Regents' continued commitment to build the university. But as we had discussions with the board, they had many questions and concerns. We talked a lot about overcoming the risk of entering into a 39-year contract with a single developer. We talked about cost of capital issues. We talked about very specific contractual matters. Within our community, it meant negotiating a raft of transportation and city services agreements that were necessary to allow us to grow. Within the state, it meant securing support of key elected officials, the Department of Finance, through the AB 94 process, and working for the support of our labor groups and our employees. Our negotiations in general were somewhat more challenging because of the questions about the delivery model we selected, and because it's relatively new in the United States, and we were adapting it along the way to fit the needs of our campus. And people had questioned whether a model that worked for bridges and other types of infrastructure was appropriate for a project with the scope and complexity of ours. But we worked diligently and as best as we could with as many stakeholders as we could along the way to try to answer those questions. And of course, we know we can't reach everybody, but we spent a lot of time in our planning process trying to do that. And all the questions we got, we believe in the end, helped us refine and improve the project. But some of the doubts and some of the hard conversations with the Board of Regents also occurred in public. And we were managing a procurement process along the way. And so the infrastructure market and the folks who were trying to bid on this project were seeing those concerns. And we know that at times they were doubting whether or not the political support was truly there to build the project. And so we had to manage that along the way as well. And so all of this took an incredible team. Our chancellor, our provost, our university community, Nathan Brostrom, our system-wide CFO, President Napolitano, the Board of Regents, dedicated teams of the project on campus and at the office of the president. We were able to navigate a lot of these because it was recognized how important this project was, and it was truly a priority for the system, and so we were able to spend a lot of time and energy working together. But I can't understate enough the importance of stakeholder engagement, because we know at the end of the day we're not going to be successful if our stakeholders are not successful. So that also made us think a lot about how the infrastructure itself, and this, I'll wrap up on this, the infrastructure itself is not the service. We had to think a lot about the performance standards, what we wanted to control, and what we were putting into this procurement. And so we talked a lot and thought, and I thought a lot about what is the infrastructure and what are the public services we're providing. You know, the school building itself is not the public service. Of course, it's the teaching that goes on in the school. I came from the transportation world, and thinking about that, the road itself is not the public service. It's actually the ability to move people and goods along that system that is the service. And so one of the key principles in our development strategy is that our civil and social infrastructure really should be the enabler of the services that UC Merced provides, which means in order to hold true to that principle, we had to think about the functionality and the reliability that we needed from our facilities. So we had to move towards outcomes-based approaches. And this was a significant change for our stakeholders and from the way we delivered buildings in the past. Our stakeholders had to learn not to select the technology that was going to achieve our policies, but rather set the policy itself and hold the developer accountable for allowing us to achieve that policy. And in doing so, we're able to shift considerable risk for the choices of technologies to the developer, but only on the condition we allow them to select the technology. And that required giving up a degree of design control and instead to focus on the performance standards. I'll give an example. The buildings being delivered will meet, as I said earlier, the energy performance standards of the University of California, and they'll all achieve LEED Gold certification. And so that meant that we and our technical standards would not decide on the type of windows. We wouldn't require double-paned windows or these, you know, to select amongst three or four different types of HVAC systems. We had to leave those choices to the developer. What we told them was the buildings had to be 20% better than Title 24, and they had to be LEED Gold. And being comfortable with those performance standards, they could select the technologies. But that change also required us to spend a lot of time thinking about how we would write those performance standards and build them into the contract. And that was a very hard part of the process and something we struggled mightily with. And that did put some pressure on our timelines. And sometimes individuals lacked faith that the private sector could come in and help us achieve our policy objectives. So moving towards outcomes-based approaches was a big piece of change management for us, but it enabled us in the end to foster competition to achieve those goals. So we have many lessons. I would love to get to questions and have more of a dialogue about them. So again, just thank you for inviting us here today and for engaging in this conversation.
My name's Tony Kane, and I'd like to get a little more specificity about the terms life cycle, useful life. When I hear those terms, I think, well, the building has to be torn down and rebuilt, and that's it. On the other hand, I think of buildings like Hearst, or I think of South Hall, 100 years, you know, over 100 years mm-hmm. old. And if you maintain a building, you keep the roof from leaking, and, you know, it will mm-hmm. maintain the elevators, that the buildings should last for 100 or longer years. So I'm wondering, when you hear that, when you say that term, what do you actually mean? Are they, how long do you actually expect these buildings to be standing there? And are they, does it vary from one building to another? And how do you determine these things?
So the contract provides for handback provisions. And in those handback provisions, there's a very common term in the industry for facilities costs, facilities conditions index. And the handback provisions are based upon that index. And the short answer is that when the contract expires in 39 years, the facilities we build will essentially be at an 80% useful life level. Typically, if we build a building and don't maintain it or repair it, a roofing system may be a 30-year life. An HVAC system may be a 20 or 30-year life. So what we will get back is buildings in good repair that will then continue to last the test of time. Just like the buildings we own, the university would have the responsibility for maintaining them at that point in time. You could envision different choices. The university could then procure another long-term contract for somebody to come in and maintain those facilities for another 30 years. But the buildings we're building will all be made out of concrete slab. They will have the ability to stand the test of time so long as we maintain them.
The original campus had very large issues associated with permitting, mm-hmm. as many of us know. And that's the reason for the choice of the golf course. Mm-hmm. Does this expansion stay just on the golf course, or are you having to go beyond it?
It does go beyond it. And if we pull back up the map, the original golf course, this is Lake and Bellevue Road here. And the original permitting for the campus allowed us to come down to this area and then up along that barrier. And so it is coming much further south. The long-range development plan that was adopted in 2009 also included an environmental impact report for these up to the second phase of campus, which was called the 2020 Project, and it's why we kept that name. And in that, there were environmental mitigations obligations that were specified, which included the remediation of several vernal pools in the area. The university, in parallel with moving this project forward, we had other projects that we had to go complete, which we have and are under construction now for the restoration of. And I apologize, I'm not remembering the number of acres, but a significant amount of vernal pools in the regional area to mitigate for those environmental impacts.
Given that of necessity you had to give up some of the details to the developer on the buildings, and given that, say, a lab science building, especially one that has animal research and so on, has very different requirements than one for humanities or else, how and to what extent were faculty and academic personnel involved in the planning and design of the buildings?
I think we can both. Yeah, well, yeah. I'll start, and you may want to follow up. The planning process for the project, we began with charrettes that were done by our technical team, who interviewed 36 groups on campus. Groups of faculty, deans from each of the schools were looking at our enrollment trajectories that were established at the time. That process happened to coalesce with a process that the Office of the President had asked each campus to develop a long-range enrollment plan in 2012, fairly similar to the current process we're going through, but much more comprehensive. And for our campus, we took that very seriously in terms of aligning our enrollment models to what we were building. And so we were able to, through that process and working with our own architectural advisors, our our campus architects and engineers, but also a team we hired to help us through that process, begin to identify a program of spaces of what we would need. And then we began to reconcile that and working with Tom and his office and with the faculty, thinking about how to organize the laboratory spaces. So we tried to start very broadly and then hone in on what we needed. And the last thing I would say is, we ran parallel processes. We wanted to develop a program that reflected what we thought we needed for a campus of 10,000 and with the goals and objectives we had for the project, irrespective of what the budget was. And of course, at the end of the day, we had to very much bring it in under a very stringent budget. And so we were developing those budgetary capacities in parallel, knowing that as we got to the end of our initial process, we probably have more desires than we could afford. And indeed, that was the case. And so we had to make adjustments as we went along. The original plans had, we wanted to look at developing a 5,000 student arena. And I think through this process, we realized we're just not ready for that. And as we prioritized everything we wanted to build, I can say that the academic spaces and sufficient housing for freshmen and sophomores always rose to the top, and that was pervasive through the process.
I'll just add two sentences. One, I think directly to your question, what was the input? So, no, the faculty did not pick the color of the tiles in the laboratories or the types of cabinetry, but they were absolutely an integral part of the conversation about we need a vivarium, we need a BSL-3 facility, we need space for a maker lab, etc. So it was in those broad brush terms. These are the, as Dan said, these are the overall requirements. Now you come back and tell us how you're going to meet those requirements. All right, and so it makes a lot of us uncomfortable, because I think we're used to, especially as faculty members, used to being in there and specifying right down to the, as I said, the color of the tile. But that we had to give up a little bit of flexibility on.
There are many people who'd like to speak, and I think one more question, and then you can come up and speak to our guests while others have lunch or both.
Is that me? Michael, is that me? Okay. Bill Lacey, University of California, Davis. Thanks again for a very interesting presentation. I wanted to ask you a bit about your vision for the undergraduate student body. 99% California residents makes you a fairly unique university. Many of our other sister campuses are striving for 15 to 20% out of state. And I just got back from Australia, where some of the institutions have a third of their student body, almost 50% of their student body, outside the country. What is your vision for the future of your student body?
That's a great question. And I think there are a lot of dimensions to that. Let's be clear. You know, we're not anti-students from outside of California, but we were put there in that particular location with a very specific mission, and that is first and foremost, with regard to our undergraduate population, meet the needs of California residents and focus especially on this tremendously underserved region of our state. I mean, and let's face it, people have often referred to that region at times as the Appalachia of California. So we have what a golden opportunity to bring a research university experience to those students. And we take that mission very seriously. We also have made a compact with the Office of the President. We, you know, unlike all the other campuses, which are under what's called the rebenching formula, we have a special arrangement for a period of time that, you know, we will focus on primarily on undergraduates from California, and that's part of our compact. I think in time you will see, you know, the out of state and international undergraduate population increase. It's important for the diversity of any campus. So we embrace that, but we're not going to be at 20% out of state or international students anytime soon. And it's also, I mean, let's face it, it's also related to the out of the state reputation of the institution. We don't quite have the name recognition that Berkeley has right now. We're working towards it, but we've got a ways to go.
Great. I'm really sorry to cut this short, so I'm really encouraging people to come up and
and continue the dialogue. We have a wonderful lunch set up. Thanks, not only the lunch, but all the arrangements. Thanks to Diana Baltadano. And also I want to mention that a week from today we have a very interesting colloquium on distance learning, comparing the Stanford and Berkeley experiences. Mitchell Stevens from Stanford and Diana Wu from Cal will be comparing notes. That should be really very special. So let's give a big hand to thank our speakers.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.